Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into the world of international climate action, specifically Article 6 of the Paris Agreement. You've given us some study guides and even a decision document from a recent UN climate change conference. That sounds pretty technical, but basically it's about how countries can team up to fight climate change.
That's right. Think of Article 6 as a global rulebook for countries to collaborate on reducing emissions. It's like setting up a system where everyone can work together to reach their climate goals more efficiently.
Okay, so how does this collaboration actually work? Is it like everyone just sits around a giant conference table and makes promises?
It's more sophisticated than that. Article 6 creates a framework for countries to trade emissions reductions, kind of like a global carbon market. The idea is if one country can reduce emissions more cheaply than another, they can trade those extra reductions to help other countries meet their targets.
That's interesting. So instead of every country having to do everything on their own, they can work together and leverage their strengths. I see we've got two main approaches laid out here. Cooperative approaches under Article 6.2 and a centralized mechanism under Article 6.4. Yeah. What's the difference?
Cooperative approaches are more like bilateral agreements between countries. Imagine two countries making a deal to work together on a specific project that reduces emissions. They get to decide the specifics of their collaboration.
Okay.
The centralized mechanism is a bit more formal. It sets up a UN-managed system. For issuing and tracking emissions credits, countries can earn credits by reducing emissions and then trade those credits with other countries. It's a more standardized system.
So it's kind of like choosing between a tailor-made suit and buying one off the rack. Both can look great.
That's a good analogy.
But one gives you a bit more control over the details. Now, the study guide really emphasizes this concept of authorization, especially for those cooperative approaches. It seems like you can't just shake hands and call it a day. What needs to be authorized?
Absolutely. Authorization is all about ensuring transparency and accountability. You can't just say you've reduced emissions. You need proof. So there are three main things that need authorization.
Okay.
First, the cooperative approach itself. Both countries need to formally agree to work together. Second, the specific emissions reductions being traded, called internationally transferred mitigation outcomes, or ITMOs for short, need authorization. Basically, they have to prove those reductions are real and haven't been countered already. And finally, any entity involved in the transfer, like a company or organization, needs to be authorized as well.
It sounds like they're really trying to cover all the bases here, making sure everything is above board and legit. So I'm guessing that's where this first transfer thing comes in. The document dives deep into that. It seems pretty important.
It is. First transfer is all about preventing double counting. Think of it like a timestamp. On each emissions reduction, it records when a reduction was first used for a specific purpose, like contributing to a country's nationally determined contribution, their climate pledge.
Oh, okay, I see. So NDCs are like each country's individual climate homework assignment. And these ITMOs are like getting extra credit you can share.
That's a great way to put it. The first transfer mechanism makes sure you can't use the same extra credit twice.
Clever. I'm starting to understand why all this technical stuff matters. It's like building a system where everyone can trust each other. The decision document also mentions a centralized accounting and reporting platform, or CRA. And there's a lot about Article 6 technical expert reviews. Is this all about making sure nobody's cooking the book?
Exactly. Transparency is key.
Sure.
Think of the CRP as a giant public ledger where all the information about these emissions transfers is recorded. Everything's out in the open, just like a public company's financial statements. And then you've got these expert review teams who act like auditors. They go through everything with a fine-tooth comb to make sure the numbers add up and that the rules are being followed.
Wow, it sounds like they're really serious about making the system work. It's not just a bunch of empty promises. They're putting in the effort to track everything and hold everyone accountable.
Absolutely. Remember, the ultimate goal here is to actually reduce emissions and address climate change effectively. All these mechanisms and rules are designed to ensure that's happening.
Okay, we've established that Article 6 is about setting clear rules for this global collaboration on climate action. It's all starting to make sense. But this is the deep dive. So let's dig a little deeper into these documents. What else jumps out at you?
One thing that's particularly interesting is how Article 6 addresses the needs of countries that are most vulnerable to climate change, like least developed countries and small island developing states.
That's a really important point. It wouldn't be fair for those countries who have contributed the least to climate change to bear the biggest burden. What kind of special considerations do they get?
The agreement tries to level the playing field by minimizing any additional burdens on them. For example, when it comes to activities happening under Article 6.4, these vulnerable countries are exempt from contributing a share of the proceeds to the Adaptation Fund.
Hold on, back up a sec. What's the Adaptation Fund?
It's basically a pot of money dedicated to helping developing countries adapt to the impacts of climate change, things like sea level rise, droughts, and extreme weather events. The idea is that a portion of the proceeds from emissions trading under Article 6.4 goes towards this fund to support adaptation projects.
Okay, that makes sense. So vulnerable countries are exempt from having to contribute to that fund, which eases the financial burden on them.
Exactly. It's about recognizing that these countries already face disproportionate challenges from climate change and ensuring they're not further disadvantaged by the system. But even though they're exempt, these countries can still choose to contribute to the Adaptation Fund if they wish. It's all about flexibility and giving them control over their own climate action strategies.
That's really important. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It's about empowering those countries to make the choices that work best for them. Now, I also noticed something about transitioning old clean development mechanism projects into this new Article 6.4 system. Is that like upgrading from a flip phone to the latest smartphone?
That's a good analogy, but it's not as simple as just trading in your old phone.
Huh?
These CDM projects are set up under the previous International Climate Agreement, the Kyoto Protocol, now with the Paris Agreement. There's a new set of rules.
So those old projects need to be brought up to code.
Precisely. There are deadlines and criteria for transitioning these projects. For example, the request for transition has to be submitted by December 31, 2025, and the host country's designated national authority needs to give it the thumbs up. The activity also has to comply with all the new Article 6.4 rules and procedures.
It sounds like they're not letting anything slide. They want to make sure these projects are up to snuff before they can join the new system.
Exactly. One of the key differences is the way emissions removals are handled. Article 6.4 has stricter requirements for removals, things like planting trees or restoring ecosystems that absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. It's all about ensuring that these removals are real, permanent, and contribute to overall environmental integrity.
That makes sense. You don't want countries claiming credit for removals that are just temporary or have other negative environmental impacts. So who's in charge of making sure everyone plays by the rules in this new system?
One of the key players is the supervisory body. They play a critical role in overseeing the Article 6.4 mechanism. Think of them as the referees of this global carbon market.
Okay, so what do these referees actually do?
They wear many hats. They develop and revise the methodologies for calculating emissions reductions, set standards for activities involving removals, and manage the mechanism registry. They make sure everyone is playing by the rules and that the system is working properly. They also report back to the big boss.
And who's the big boss in this scenario?
The big boss is the CMA, the Conference of the Parties, serving as the meeting of the parties to the Paris Agreement. It's a mouthful, I know. But basically, it's the governing body that makes the big decisions about the Paris Agreement.
So it's like the school board. For the Global Climate Club, they set the policies and the supervisory body makes sure everyone's following them.
That's a great way to think about it. This whole system is about creating a structure for international cooperation. But you need checks and balances to ensure it's effective and fair.
Speaking of checks and balances, one thing that keeps coming up is this concept of double counting. They seem really determined to prevent that.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like they've got all sorts of mechanisms in place.
Absolutely. Double counting is one of the biggest risks with a system like this. You don't want countries claiming credit for the same emissions reduction twice, inflating their achievements and undermining the whole purpose of the agreement.
Okay, so how do they prevent that? Explain it to me like I'm a detective trying to solve a case of stolen carbon credits.
Right, detective. Here's the rundown. The first transfer principle is our key piece of evidence. It establishes when an emissions reduction is first used, whether for a country's own climate target, their NDC, or for other international mitigation purposes. Think of it as putting a unique tracking number on each emissions reduction.
So it's like a fingerprint that identifies each reduction and make sure it can't be used twice.
Exactly.
But what if someone tries to tamper with the evidence? How do they make sure the fingerprints are legit?
That's where robust accounting and reporting come in. Remember the CIP, our giant public ledger? Well, it's not just sitting there collecting dust. The CRP keeps a detailed record of every transaction, like a digital trail of breadcrumbs.
So they can follow the trail to see where each emissions reduction came from and where it went.
Exactly. And if there's any doubt, the Article 6 technical expert review teams step in. They're like our forensic specialists examining the evidence to make sure everything adds up. They check for inconsistencies in the data, missing information, anything that looks suspicious.
They're like the quality control inspectors of the global carbon market, making sure everything is up to standard. But it's not just about catching the bad guys, right? They also need to make sure the system is user-friendly and accessible for everyone.
Designing a system that works for all countries, especially those with fewer resources, is a key challenge. That's why capacity building is such a crucial aspect of Article 6.
So capacity building is about giving everyone the tools and training they need to participate effectively.
Precisely. It involves things like organizing workshops, developing guidance materials, and providing financial assistance to help countries develop their own robust systems for accounting, reporting, and verification of emissions reductions. It's about leveling the playing field.
That's really important. You can't expect countries to follow the rules if they don't have the capacity to understand and implement them.
Right.
It's like giving someone a complex recipe without teaching them how to cook.
Exactly. Capacity building is about empowering countries to take ownership of their climate action and to participate in the system in a meaningful way. It's about creating a level playing field where everyone can contribute to the global effort to combat climate change.
It's really inspiring to see this commitment to collaboration and support. It shows a real understanding of the diverse challenges that different countries face. Now, one thing that's been bugging me is how they actually handle these changes to authorizations. We talked about authorization earlier. But what happens if circumstances change and countries need to adjust their initial agreements?
That's a great question. The decision document on cooperative approaches outlines a specific process for managing changes to authorization. It recognizes that flexibility is important, but stresses that any changes must be done in a transparent and accountable way. And you guessed it, must avoid double counting.
Of course. Double counting seems to be the cardinal sin of Article 6. So let's say two countries are working together on a project to reduce emissions, but then one of them updates its national climate pledge, their NDC. How would they adjust their authorization to reflect that change?
That's a perfect example. In that scenario, the countries would need to follow the agreed-upon process for amending their original authorization. They would need to document the reasons for the change, provide updated accounting information, and ensure that any previously transferred emissions reductions are not affected by the change.
So they're basically hitting the edit button on their agreement, but with a lot of safeguards to make sure everything stays transparent and consistent.
That's a great way to put it. They can't just go back and erase what's already been done. Mm-hmm. The first transfer principle still applies, so any emissions reductions that have already been accounted for can't be double counted.
Makes sense. It's like updating a software program. You want to improve it, but you don't want to break the existing code.
Exactly. And just like with software updates, transparency is key. All changes to authorizations need to be publicly documented and reported so everyone can see what's been adjusted and why.
Speaking of transparency, the document also mentions this concept of sequencing and timing of reporting. It sounds a bit like a bureaucratic nightmare. What's that all about?
It sounds more complicated than it is. It's essentially about setting clear deadlines and a logical order for submitting reports. This ensures that information flows smoothly and that everyone is on the same page.
Okay, so walk me through the steps. What comes first?
The first step is for participating countries to submit an initial report, or an updated report if they've made changes, outlining the details of their cooperative approach. This report covers things like how the cooperation works, the methods they're using for accounting, and the safeguards they've put in place to ensure environmental integrity.
So it's like setting the stage, explaining the ground rules before they start sharing emissions reductions.
Exactly. This initial report acts as a foundation for everything else. It has to be submitted before they can provide annual information on the emissions reductions that have been traded.
And I'm guessing they're not just sending these reports via snail mail.
Definitely not. The annual information on those ITMOs, the traded emissions reductions, has to be submitted in an agreed electronic format. Think digital spreadsheets, not stacks of paper.
It's the 21st century, after all. Gotta love the efficiency of technology. But even with the best technology, there's always a chance for human error, right? What happens if there are inconsistencies in the data or disagreements between countries?
That's where the process for identifying, notifying, and correcting inconsistencies comes into play. Think of it as a system for resolving disputes and ensuring that everyone is being honest and accurate in their reporting.
Okay, so how does this dispute resolution system work?
The first line of defense is automated. Remember those tech wizards at the Secretariat? They've developed software that can automatically scan the submitted data for inconsistencies and red flags.
So it's like a spell check for climate data.
Exactly. It can catch simple errors or missing information. But for more complex issues, we need human intervention. That's where the Article 6 technical expert review teams come in.
Our climate detectives are back on the case.
That's right. These teams are composed of experts who can thoroughly examine the data, identify any discrepancies, and work with countries to resolve them.
So it's a collaborative process, not just a finger-pointing exercise.
Exactly. The goal is to ensure the accuracy and transparency of the data, not to punish countries for making mistakes. If an inconsistency is found, the Secretariat notifies the countries involved and makes the issue public.
Ah, so public shaming is a motivational tool.
Let's call it transparency and accountability. Knowing that inconsistencies will be made public encourages countries to be extra diligent in their reporting and to address any issues promptly. And if a country is dragging its feet or refusing to cooperate, the issue is escalated to the CMA. Remember the school board?
So there are consequences for bad behavior. But what are those consequences? Do they get detention or extra homework?
The decision document doesn't specify any penalties. But even without formal punishments, there's a strong incentive for countries to play by the rules.
How so?
Imagine you're a country trying to attract investors for climate-friendly projects. You want to be known as the country that's sloppy with its emissions accounting or tries to bend the rules. Probably not. It's all about reputation and credibility.
It's like getting a bad credit score in the global climate community. Nobody wants to do business with someone who can't be trusted. So it's more about peer pressure and maintaining a good standing,
right,
and about strict punishments.
And that's actually a powerful motivator. Countries care about their image on the world stage. They want to be seen as leaders in climate action.
Speaking of leadership, the study guide stresses the importance of sustainable development. Within Article 6.4 activities, it's not just about reducing emissions for the sake of reducing emissions. It's about doing it in a way that benefits people and the planet.
Absolutely. Sustainable development is woven into the fabric of Article 6.4. It's not an afterthought. The goal is to ensure that these emissions reduction activities contribute to broader social and economic progress, not undermine it.
So it's not just about crunching numbers. It's about making sure those numbers translate into real-world benefits,
right,
for communities and ecosystems. But how do they actually ensure that sustainable development principles are being put into practice? Is it just wishful thinking? Or are there concrete mechanisms for making it happen?
It's definitely not just wishful thinking. They've developed a specific tool to address this, the Article 6.4 Sustainable Development Tool. It's designed to assess and ensure the sustainable development benefits of Article 6.4 activities.
So it's like an impact assessment, making sure these projects aren't just good for the climate, but also good for people and the environment.
Precisely. It's about looking at the bigger picture beyond just emissions reductions. The tool helps to ensure that projects are contributing to things like environmental integrity, social well-being, and economic development. It also takes into account things like gender equality, indigenous people's rights, and the protection of biodiversity.
That's impressive. It sounds like they're really trying to cover all the bases. Mm. But who actually uses this tool? And how do we know they're not just ticking boxes and ignoring the results?
That's a great question. The decision document emphasizes the importance of transparency and stakeholder engagement in this process. It calls for transparent and inclusive decision-making processes that include opportunities for public participation and scrutiny.
So it's not just up to the countries involved,
yeah,
to decide what's sustainable. They need to involve the people who are most affected by these projects.
Exactly. Local communities, indigenous peoples, and civil society organizations all need to have a seat at the table. Their insights and perspectives are crucial for ensuring that these projects are truly beneficial and don't have unintended negative consequences.
It's about making sure that climate action doesn't come at the expense of people's livelihoods or cultural heritage. It needs to be a win-win,
right,
for everyone involved. But what happens if a project doesn't meet the sustainable development criteria? Are there any consequences?
While the decision document doesn't lay out specific penalties, the sustainable development tool is meant to be more than just a suggestion. It's designed to safeguard environmental integrity and social well-being. So if a project raises red flags during the assessment, it's unlikely to get approved.
So it's like a quality control check. Projects that don't meet the standards are weeded out.
Exactly. And remember, transparency is key. All the information about these assessments is publicly available, so anyone can see how projects are being evaluated and whether they're meeting the sustainable development criteria.
It's really encouraging to see that they're not just paying lip service to sustainable development. They're putting real mechanisms in place to make it a core part of Article 6.
Absolutely. It's a recognition that climate action can't happen in a vacuum. It needs to be part of a broader effort to create a more just and sustainable world for everyone.
It's about recognizing that we're all interconnected and that our actions have consequences for others. Speaking of interconnectedness, one thing that's become clear is that we can't address climate change in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
It requires international cooperation. And that's where organizations like the UN come in, right?
Absolutely. International organizations play a vital role in supporting the implementation of Article 6. They provide technical expertise, financial resources, and capacity building support to countries, especially developing countries, that may have limited resources or technical capacity.
It's like they're the scaffolding supporting the entire structure of Article 6. Can you give us some examples of the specific roles these organizations play?
Certainly. The UNFCCC secretariat's like the administrative backbone of Article 6. They manage the CRP, conduct the automated consistency checks, and prepare reports on the overall progress of the system. They're essentially the ones making sure everything runs smoothly.
They're the ones keeping the trains running on time. What about the financial side of things? Who's providing the resources to make all this happen?
The Green Climate Fund, or GCF, is a major player in that arena. They provide funding for climate mitigation and adaptation projects. In developing countries, including those under Article 6, they help to mobilize the investments needed to scale up climate action globally.
So they're like the bankrolling this whole operation, making sure there's enough capital flowing to where it's needed most.
That's a good analogy. And then you have organizations like the UNDP and UNEP that focus on capacity building. They help countries develop the skills and expertise they need to participate effectively in Article 6 activities, from designing projects to managing data to monitoring and reporting on their progress.
It's like they're running a global training program for climate action, equipping countries with the knowledge and tools they need to succeed.
Exactly. It's about empowering countries to take ownership of their climate action.
Yeah.
And to be active participants in the global effort to combat climate change.
It's a reminder that we're not alone in this fight. We have a global network of support working together to achieve a common goal.
Precisely. It's a testament to the power of international collaboration and the recognition that climate change is a challenge that transcends national borders.
It's about recognizing that we're all interconnected and that our actions have consequences for others. It's amazing how a topic that sounded so technical at first has turned out to be about so much more than just rules and regulations. We've uncovered a whole ecosystem of collaboration, innovation, and even a bit of global camaraderie in this deep dive into Article 6.
Article 6 is a testament to the fact that global challenges require global solutions. It's a framework for countries to work together, share knowledge, and pool resources to achieve something they couldn't do alone.
We've talked a lot about the nuts and bolts of how Article 6 works, but let's zoom out for a moment and talk about the bigger picture. Why is this so important in the grand scheme of things?
Article 6 is crucial because it provides a practical pathway for countries to achieve the goals of the Paris Agreement. Remember, the Paris Agreement aims to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius, preferably to 1.5 degrees. Compared to pre-industrial levels, that's a huge undertaking. It requires a rapid and sustained reduction in global greenhouse gas emissions.
And Article 6 helps to accelerate that reduction by creating a system where emissions reductions can be traded and shared.
Exactly. By allowing countries to cooperate and leverage their strengths. Article 6 helps to make emissions reductions more efficient and cost-effective. It's like creating a global marketplace for climate action, where countries can work together to achieve a common goal.
It's about recognizing that we're all in this together and that we need to work together to find solutions. But even with the best intentions, a system like this can only be as effective as the people who are implementing it right.
Absolutely. The success of Article 6 hinges on the commitment and collaboration of governments, businesses, organizations, and individuals around the world. It's about translating these agreements and mechanisms into real action on the ground.
So it's not just about policymakers signing treaties. It's about everyone doing their part to reduce emissions, support sustainable practices, and hold each other accountable.
Precisely. It's a collective effort, a shared responsibility to protect our planet and secure a sustainable future. And that responsibility extends beyond national borders. It requires international cooperation, knowledge sharing, and a willingness to learn from each other.
Speaking of learning from each other, one of the things that impressed me about Article 6 is how it encourages continuous improvement. It's not a static set of rules.
Right.
It's designed to evolve and adapt as we gain more experience and knowledge.
You're right. The Paris Agreement and Article 6 within it is a living document. It recognizes that we're on a learning journey and that we need to be flexible and adaptable in our approach to climate change. The mechanisms and rules are constantly being refined and improved based on new scientific insights, technological advancements, and lessons learned from practical implementation.
It's almost like a giant experiment where we're all trying to figure out the best ways to reduce emissions and build a more sustainable future.
That's a great way to think about it. We're all in this together, testing out different approaches, sharing our experiences, and constantly striving to do better. And that's where the human element comes in. The creativity, innovation, and determination to find solutions.
I love that perspective. It's not about being perfect from the start. It's about being willing to learn, to adapt, and to keep pushing forward.
Exactly. And that's what gives me hope. Despite the scale and complexity of the climate challenge, there's a global community of people working together, sharing knowledge, and coming up with innovative solutions. Article 6 is just one piece of that puzzle, but it's a crucial piece that enables us to work together more effectively.
It's been an incredible journey, exploring all the nuances of Article 6. We've covered a lot of ground, from the technical details of emissions trading to the importance of sustainable development and the role of international cooperation. What's the one key takeaway you hope our listeners will walk away with?
I hope listeners will understand that Article 6 isn't just some abstract international agreement. It's a living, breathing framework that empowers us to take concrete action on climate change. It's about collaboration, innovation, and a shared commitment to building a more sustainable future.
Beautifully said. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Article 6 of the Paris Agreement. We encourage you to continue exploring this topic, to stay engaged in the conversation, and to be part of the solution. Remember, every action, no matter how small, can make a difference.